This episode will include sensitive content. Please visit the show notes for more details and listen at your own discretion. Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime reporter and Washington, D.C. special police officer. And today in the studio, we welcome Mark and Julie Shealy.
You have to be a good communicator. You have to be a good listener.
Also, the ability to adapt to a situation under duress.
They both have well over 30 years of service under their belts with the United States Marshal Service, which is the law enforcement arm for the nation's federal courts. Julie retired as a senior inspector and Mark as a chief inspector.
It's a game. You're not always going to get the truth. Just because you have a badge and a gun doesn't mean you're going to get the truth.
Their careers have taken them around the world, working with international fugitives and some of the most notorious detainees in D.C. And all the while, partners in work as well as life.
It's not just a job. It's actually your lifestyle.
Thank you for being here.
Good seeing you.
Yes, thank you.
So your husband and wife, both U.S. Marshals, how did you two meet?
I think I'll tell that story.
Let Julie tell the story. So how'd you meet?
We were on a fugitive, I think, stop operation, street terror offender program.
Here in D.C.
Here in D.C. Mm-hmm. And I worked at the headquarters element. I handled the purse strings. Mark worked for the, out of the Navy Yard, mm-hmm. that branch of the actual working warrants. He came into headquarters one day looking for the files for their team. I was out of the office, came back, and saw this man sitting at my desk with his feet upon the desk, and I politely asked him if he put his feet down. He said, excuse me, I asked him if he would take his feet off my desk. Uh-huh. He looked at the barcode on the desk and said, excuse me, it belongs to the government.
Oh, so. Snap. No, he didn't.
Oh, yeah. That was my style.
Oh, you were just feeling yourself back then, huh?
Yeah, it's quite rude.
Okay.
No, but...
So, go on.
We, after we made that exchange and he told me why he was there, I instructed him where he needed to get his box and go, which he did. And then I think it was the next day I had to do kind of a presentation of how to do their timesheets and report all the financial things back to me. He actually, you know, spoke to me. He was very kind that day. Mm-hmm. But it gave him another day, and he actually asked me out for dinner, which was unusual because I didn't like him at the time. He really made me mad, telling me that it was a government desk.
It was. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And so what happened from there? You went out to dinner?
We went out to dinner. Actually, it's not that he paid. Where we stayed, they had like the free buffet. It was Embassy Suites where they offer you dinner. So he uh-huh. came over, and that was the date. So it really cost him nothing. We got to know each other, laughed, joked, had a good time, and then he actually asked me out on an official date, which we went to the fish market the next day.
Over in Alexandria, yes.
The next day. So we started, it was a great friendship. Really wasn't a date. We just got to know each other at the time. I didn't think we really started dating until almost close to the end of the assignment. And we were great friends.
And then you got married and yeah. continued your careers within the U.S. Marshal Service.
Yes.
Yeah, we worked a lot of cases together, and we spent a lot of Saturday nights together at the hotline at America's Most Wanted. Whenever I had a case on, I would have to be there on the hotline to work right. with the officers from the local department or whatever federal agency that case was from. And you two were typically embedded on the hotline every Saturday night to field tips and to cast that wider net as marshals to go after people outside of local jurisdictions.
America's Most Wanted was a cheap date night every time the show was on, as far as Julie coming with me and working the cases that we worked. There was that give and take with between, and this has been our entire careers, what she's very good at and what I'm very good mm-hmm. at. It's something that meshes very well as far as her taking information, putting that information. And there's always it's good to get that other perspective. And sometimes, like I said, she would bring me back online as to my way of thinking. But there were multiple cases that we worked over the years.
I think the first time I went, Mark kept referring to, as he said, he goes, I got the perfect thing for you. We're going to have date night. It's going to be cheap date night. And, of course, we ended up at America's Most Wanted. And from that Saturday on, it was every Saturday.
I remember one case in particular, America's Most Wanted. a grandmother from Arkansas called. She goes, I need help getting my grandkids back. And I listened to what she had to say, and I took the information, and she explained everything to me. Her daughter and the daughter's boyfriend, for whatever reason, decided to take off with the grandkids. And they had contacted the local police to try to get them to do anything. And I'm not slamming the local department, but mm-hmm. I said, what, you know, give me the information. She gave me the vehicle information. So I contacted the local department, and I said, listen, just do this favor for me. And that's the influence of saying you're a U.S. Marshal. That mm-hmm. helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. You just call them out of the blue.
I called them out of the blue, and mm-hmm. I said, here's the information. Just do a bolo on it. Be on the lookout mm-hmm. for this vehicle. That's all I need to know. And we sent the lookout out, and we got a call back from the vehicle was spotted in Portland, Oregon. And the PD contacted us, and I contacted the marshal's office in Portland. I said, do me a favor. Here's the info. Contact this guy with the Portland PD, and they were able to find the vehicle. They found the kids. They were out on the street panhandling with the boyfriend, you know, which was unbelievable to think of. But the following week after we got the kids back, the grandmother called back to AMW hotline. She goes, I have somebody who wants to talk to you. And the 10-year-old girl got on the phone.
Wow.
And getting a little emotional about
I know. I can see it. I can see it. It's but that's just so wonderful that you were able to do that for that grandmother and for those kids. And that's the humanity of putting your profession to work for people.
Yeah, she called back and said, thank you for getting me home to my grandmother. Those were great times back then.
Now, Mark, when did you decide you wanted to go into law enforcement and why?
It goes back quite a few years. When I graduated from high school, like a lot of kids, you know, what am I going to do now? And I knew I wanted to continue to do something that got me out and about and not behind a desk. My father at the time was working for the Marshal Service, and he started telling me all the stories and the people, and he said, you know, might want to think about it. And as he told me more, I got more and more interested and went ahead and put in, and I started working in D.C. in March of 83.
And you, Julie, when did you decide you wanted to go into law enforcement?
When I was working for IRS out in Portland, Oregon, I met Marshal Kernan Bagley, who told me, why don't you come over and work for a real agency? So I said, okay, well, let me see what you have. At that time, they only had administrative positions open. So I came on administratively. In doing some of the, well, they called them matrons then, excuse me, there was very few deputies, female deputies, and I decided that that's the route I was going to go. I mean, I enjoyed, you know, working on one side, but I wanted to see the other side. It wasn't until after I had moved back home because my mother became ill that I decided I was going to put that on the shelf for a little bit. And so I started the process again of trying to become a deputy. So it took me about 2 years going through the process. And firearms was nothing for me because my father always went hunting with a shotgun. Mm-hmm. I was comfortable around any type of weapon. So I worked with people like Mark all along my career with the Marshal Service administratively that just fed that desire to be on the other side.
And for you, Mark, what was your first year on the job? What was it like?
An interesting, when I first started, I started in the D.C. office, and I started in the federal courthouse doing evictions.
Well, that should be interesting.
Oh, that was, yeah, it was quite interesting. And I recall the very first day when I went into the office, you meet everybody, and one of the things that was mandatory was everybody had to go upstairs and meet Judge Sirica from the Watergate.
That Judge Sirica?
That Judge Sirica. Everybody had to meet him.
Why?
He loved the Marshal Service.
Okay.
And he had a medical emergency on the bench one day, and a deputy saved his life. And that was why it was like he was indebted to, you could never say anything negative about the Marshal Service. And I remember the deputy that was taking me upstairs, and he says, well, I have to take you up to meet Judge Sirica. And I'm thinking immediately, I said, oh, you know, from Watergate. And he goes, yeah, yeah. He goes, let me stop you right now. He said, do not say Nixon's name in front of this guy because he hated Nixon. So he said, he'll vapor lock again. I said, okay. So, you know, I went up there and he was, oh, I love you guys. You guys are great. You guys can do nothing wrong in my eyes. And mm-hmm. very, very cordial, you know, intimidating mm-hmm. meeting this guy because you read about him and you saw his face all over things. But we were paired up with deputies to do the evictions. So they sent us out in about 10, 12 teams, and we were doing about 100 a day.
Evictions?
Evictions, yeah.
Wow.
And that was...
And that's kind of heartbreaking work,
it
too.
It is extremely heartbreaking.
I mean, you're literally throwing people out of there.
Yeah, it's extremely heartbreaking. Yeah. And given the, you know, circumstances in D.C. and the way things... You know, the landlords ran that whole operation. Mm-hmm. And there were quite a few times where, you know, I made the decision, no, we're not doing this because I just don't like the circumstance. It doesn't seem right. And they said, well, you know, we're going to... I said, no. I can make that decision, and I'm making that decision. This is not right. We're not doing this. And... It was very heartbreaking. A lot of these, and you have to listen to what people have to say. Mm-hmm. You know, you're coming in there and you're executing a court order, but you still have to listen to these people and what their stories are. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, unfortunately, was unfortunate circumstances as to why it came to why we were there. And you let them. Sometimes they just had to get it off their chair. A lot of times it was a woman who's, oh, I gave my money to my boyfriend and he was supposed to be paying the rent. Well, he hasn't been paying it. And that's why we're here. Or, you know, or the landlord would come up with some ridiculous reason to put him out. Mm-hmm. And we would, you know, we would make a lot. And I don't want to just say me, all of us going out there. We were committed to doing what was right. Mm-hmm. And if it meant canceling the eviction, we would cancel.
Hey, all, a quick pause from the show to tell you about one of our sponsors today. So I love my cat. I've had her for 17 years. But as much as I love my cat, I'm not fond of the stink bombs they leave in their litter box. Everything from cleaning to covering up the smell is a constant battle. That's why I use Pretty Litter. Unlike traditional litter, Pretty Litter's super light crystals trap odor and release moisture, resulting in dry, low-maintenance litter that doesn't smell. Make the switch to Pretty Litter today by visiting prettylitter.com and use the promo code PD for 20% off your first order. Pretty Litter is shipped in a small, lightweight bag that lasts an entire month. No more bulky containers or frequent trips to the store. And you know what it's like when you run out of kitty litter. Not good. But above all else, Pretty Litter monitors my cat's health by changing colors when it detects potential underlying issues. Now that's cool. Do what I did and make the switch to Pretty Litter today by visiting prettylitter.com and use the promo code PD for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code PD for 20% off. prettylitter.com. Promo code PD. Now that the NFL season has come to an end, your favorite sports podcasts are bringing you all the NBA coverage you want. Check out the Big Podcast, the Dan Patrick Show, and the Lakers Podcast for daily NBA updates and the analysis you need before every game. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, PodcastOne.com, Apple Podcasts, or any of your favorite podcast listening apps.
Now, Julie, you were working in Superior Court here in D.C. when you started as a marshal, as a deputy marshal, right?
Yes, I was.
That is quite a zoo. The Superior Court in D.C., for those people who've never been there or seen it, it is a hotbed of activity and all kinds of personalities and people from all quadrants of the city. And there's a lot of stress levels and people are going in the courthouse and not coming back out.
That's so true.
Tell me a little bit about that environment.
I must say I loved the 10 and a half years at D.C. Superior Court.
You did 10 and a half years there?
10 and a half, and loved it.
I want to hear more about this.
I started out, again, I think everybody does that first 2 or 3 years in court. Mm-hmm. But you all start in the cell block because you got to receive the new lockups in the morning, which that could be.
New prisoners.
Yes. Uh-huh. And that could be anywhere from 100 to 200. If not more, but then also the load they brought over from the jail, which that could have been up to about 300. So you're looking at about 500 people in the cell block and maybe one to every 15 or 20.
And this is a daily transition?
Daily.
Daily.
200-300 people?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So you're trying to get them searched and put in different holding cells and ready for court. Back then, we knew, which you don't do now, but we used to daisy chain them, which you heard one to another's wrist and mm-hmm. on down the road until you did your last prisoner. And
so you might have how many daisy chained together?
6 to 10 at least.
Okay. And would you have another marshal with you?
depending on the courtroom, if it was misdemeanor, which I spent my first few years in misdemeanor, it was just me.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a felony, then you had two.
Mm-hmm. Were you armed or unarmed when you...
Unarmed.
Unarmed around the prisoners, right? That's what I thought.
Uh-huh. Yes. I mean, you had less than lethal device, mm-hmm. but you really didn't want to use it because the area that you were in was very confined.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I had... It wasn't a problem. It was never a problem for me taking individuals from the cell block up to the courtroom because I think a couple of them thought you must be crazy or you know some karate or something because mm-hmm. you don't seem bothered by it. I grew up with brothers that I fought with all the time. So, no, being around individuals or someone's taller than me didn't bother me. If I had to fight, I'd have to fight.
Did that happen? Did you have to fight a prisoner in the courthouse?
Only it's for whatever reason the juveniles have a bigger chip on their shoulder and something to prove. So the only fights that I had were with juvenile females primarily.
Can you tell me about one of them? One that sticks out in your mind?
Yes, there was four young ladies that came in. They had stomped pretty much a girl at school.
Mm-hmm.
So they get into the block, and the one that you can right away tell she's the leader. She wasn't listening to any of the instructions as I'm telling them, you know, turn around, you know, put your hands on the wall, because they were getting ready to be searched. She wanted to challenge me, and I told her, I said, look, we just need to get through this. Just listen to the commands. They're not that difficult. So she wanted to say, well, I'll do what I want to do. And I said, I'm going to tell you once. If you don't turn around, we're going to have difficulties. She said, I don't care. And before she could get care out of her mouth, mm-hmm. I had already had her pinned on the wall and handcuffed.
Mm-hmm.
The other girls were, you know, shocked at it. So they were like, we're doing it. and she's still, you know, trying to explain, well, I wasn't trying to be nasty, you know, but you weren't following directions.
Mm-hmm.
So that one, she didn't get a chance to take a swing or anything else. It's just, you know, way I grew up, if my parents would tell me once and that was it. And that's mm-hmm. pretty much the way I dealt with dealing with majority of the individuals. I'm going to tell you once. Mm-hmm. If you have difficulty understanding it, then we'll go another route. She was pretty much obedient or followed direction from that point on. Didn't have any issues with her. But at the end of the day, one of her friends was, because she's being released, and she didn't want to go face her mother. So she figured if she get in a fight, she would be held. We'd hold her, and she wouldn't have to go out there. So she actually shocked me because she did take a swing. And again, that was rather easy because uh-huh. her head quickly met the wall,
uh-huh.
Which the fight came out of her. When uh-huh. I took her out there to her mother to release it to her, I told her mother what occurred, and I explained the little knot on her forehead, which mm-hmm. her mother said, fine. She goes, I'm going to deal with that. And before I could get her mother finished signing the paperwork to be released,
mm-hmm.
Her daughter to be released to her, I heard this big smack, and I turned around like I didn't hear anything. She was like, is there a problem?
Her mom smacked her?
Her mother smacked her down when she actually hit the wall. I could hear her mother from that point on saying, I had to take off from work. I had to find somebody to get your brothers and sisters to come down here. You acting like, you know, you weren't raised properly.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, all the way down the hallway, I heard the mother just in the ear of the young girl, and she couldn't say anything.
And you worked in the courthouse, too.
I did.
And what was a memorable incident that you encountered, Mark?
I was one of few white deputies in the office.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody, when you work, you always started in the cell block, and it was like you had to kind of establish yourself. We had fights all the time
mm-hmm.
for the least little thing.
This is with male inmates?
Male, females. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the females were challenging, too.
Mm-hmm.
But...
So your first real fight you got into, you remember it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what happened?
Had a deputy, and God rest his soul, Joe Jenkins, he would promote the fights.
What do you mean?
Well, you always had the guys that would come up from Lorton, and you'd have one in there in the traffic cell, and he's jumping up and down. He had been mouthing off, so they put him in the traffic cell to keep an eye on him.
Mm-hmm.
And
he had come from Lorton Prison.
Lorton Prison down in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And he's over there shadow boxing and doing this and doing this. And Joe goes over there to talk to him. He said, oh, what are you, a boxer or something? And he starts, you know, and Joe turned and he points to me. And I'm watching him and he points to me. And he goes, I bet you can't even whip the white boy there. Oh, and that was it. Then he just started mouthing off. And Joe comes back over to me and he hands me the key to the cells. And he goes, you know, you got to do something about this. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, stop him. I said, what do you mean stop him? Go over. I said, well, I'll go. I went over there and I'm talking through the bars. I said, man, you got to calm down. Uh-huh. I said, it's not worth all of this. Uh-huh. Just calm down. And he starts, you know, talking all this. So I go over and I pop the door and he walks towards me. And as he walks towards me, he let one fly.
He throws a punch?
He threw a punch at me. He missed, but I didn't.
Uh-huh.
I've always been able to take care of myself, but, you know, that I remember. And, you know, and I went over and I started getting in Joe's, you know, behind about it. I said, you know.
Because you felt like Joe had kind of just pushed you into this situation.
Well, and that was saying later on, Joe, he pulled me aside and he says, you know why I did that?
Why?
Well, tell me. And he goes, you have to establish yourself in this cell block. And he said, first of all, he said, you're a small white guy. And he goes, I don't know. I said, yeah, I know the dynamics of the cell block, mm-hmm. Joe. And he goes, well, you have to establish yourself or these guys are going to run all over you. I said, well, I guess I established myself. And he goes, yeah, you're good.
Mm-hmm.
And word got around and I never had any more problems after that. But, and the irony of it, when I was promoted and brought back to Superior Court from District Court from working warrants all those years, I was put in charge of the cell block. And the funny thing about it, a lot of the old timers, when I got back into the block, they remembered me.
Wow.
Yeah.
They were still around.
Oh, it's a funny environment in D.C. Superior Court. You, unfortunately, the system is the way it is. It's not the best system in the world. I'll be mm-hmm. the first to say that. But you see the same people mm-hmm. over cycling through that system. And you get to know them. You get to know them. You get to know their family. They get to know you. And sometimes they're happy to see you. I've had people walking into the courthouse, out on the street, come up to me, shake my hand, give me a hug. How you doing?
Former inmates.
Foreign inmates.
Prisoners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Say, I'm doing great. How are you? I said, good seeing you out here. He goes, yeah, I'm good. So that's what's important. You know, but that goes to how we were able to, you know, interact and treat people with a certain amount of dignity and respect. That, yeah, you're on that side and I'm on this side, but it doesn't mean we can't have dialogue and we can't get along.
Mm-hmm. Well, back then in the 80s and 90s, D.C. was considered the chocolate city. It was a majority black city. And, I mean, for you, Julie, being a black female, did you find it to be an advantage or in some cases a disadvantage working in the jail and working with the inmates? How was your experience if you put it in the context of being a black female?
If it was within the courthouse, It was acceptable. It was fine. They mm-hmm. they saw me as someone that they could actually talk to. If it was on the street, I was a sellout because I'm working against them. I'm not working for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a balance. Once they end up being arrested and in the cell block, they saw me in a different light. Then it was like, hey, can you get me an extra sandwich? Or I haven't talked to an attorney yet. Is someone going to talk to me? Then they wanted the assistance, but on the street, it was a different story.
And when you got married, how long had you been in the Marshals when you became married?
I'd been in 22 years. We got married when, 95?
Wow, you have to ask that
95.
Question.
22 years.
Uh-huh. So you were veteran Marshals when you got married?
Yes.
Okay. And when you got married, being an interracial couple, what was your experience? How did people react to it?
It was we had fun with it. We played it to our advantage.
Mm-hmm.
I recall one particular incident where it worked out very well for us. We had to go down to Metropolitan Police First District to talk about an unfortunate death in this cell block, and because of the circumstances, because I was a supervisor in a cell block, I made certain decisions that didn't sit well with Metropolitan Police, and they started accusing us of covering up a crime and this and that. And I said, whoa, stop. If you're going to accuse us, I need to stop talking to you right now. And you can refer to our general counsel's office at headquarters. I said, we did our job. That's what we're, you know, I can tell you about our policies and procedures. We did our job. And the 1D commander asked if we could come down and talk. I said, yeah, I'm on my way down. And I told Julie, I said, Julie, do me a favor. Come with me. I said, bring a notepad.
Mm-hmm.
I said, just sit at the table.
Be the stenographer of this meeting?
Yes.
Well,
okay.
Uh-huh. Oh, it was great. It was great. And we got down there, and I introduced Julie. I said, this is Julie Sheely, and I'm Mark Shillis, Julie Shillis. They never put it together.
They usually don't.
They usually don't.
The same last name just didn't put two and two together.
It didn't register. But I told Jules, I just write stuff down as we talk. And the whole time I'm talking to the 1D commander, he keeps looking over at her because she's writing everything down. She's doing a grocery list and writing it down. But it was advantageous to us because it took this guy kind of off his, I need to get all over these people for not doing it, But, that was funny. He never, looked right at her. I said, this is Deputy U.S. Marshal Julie Shealy. And he never put it together that we were married.
Now, you got involved in a shooting pretty early on in your career, right?
Right.
What happened?
We were always responsible for people that escape, especially in the D.C. With the Lorton Task Force, the escapes that were out of there. But in this particular case was a guy by the name of Thomas Braxton. He escaped out of St. Elizabeth,
which was the mental hospital in Washington, D.C. for many, many decades.
Yes.
And he got out, and we were given the warrant to go find him because there was a concern about, because he had been, what got him committed to St. Elizabeth was he was involved in a shooting with the FBI. We developed the information. He was in an apartment over in Maryland, and there was four of us that went over there. It was early in the morning, and we knocked on the door. And when we knocked on the door, he started shooting through the door at us. And the running joke was one of the guys had just bought a Glock, which was a new gun at that time.
This is in the early 80s?
85. And we looked at him and we said, why did you shoot? He goes, I didn't shoot. And he's looking at the end of the gun like, no, it wasn't me. He said, somebody shot. You know, as the rounds were coming through the wall and the door at us. And then finally, the door swung open and I could smell the gunpowder. I said, no. I said, the guy inside's shooting at us. And we were able to seal off the building and lock everything down. We got the people out of the building. And
so he was still holed up in there?
Oh, yeah. He held up in there for a while. PG County SWAT eventually went in there and got him and brought him out, which surprisingly, we got some real good press out of that. They talked to all the people that lived in the building and said that we had every right to kill this guy. He was trying to kill us all. And we got him out of there safe and you know.
Julie, have you ever had to fire your weapon in the line of duty?
I have not. Which, I mean, if I had to, again, prepared for it. I'm a preacher's kid, so I'm a PK. A lot of people ask me if I would have difficulty pulling a weapon, especially with it being religious issues. I said no. Bottom line is, if it's him or me or her or me, whoever, it's going to be me going home every time. The whole point is to protect and serve. Now, if this individual decides to go another route and is out to hurt, then that's a route I have to take. But I've never had to go to the extent of pulling and firing.
And she claims she's a better shot than me anyway.
I am. I scored higher than you.
One time she scored higher than me, but that was it.
What have been some of your hardest moments and impactful moments on the job as a U.S. Marshal? You've been involved in high-stakes standoffs, pursuits, fugitive cases. If you had to narrow it down to one that stands out.
D.C. Sniper.
D.C. Sniper case.
Absolutely,
We were both involved in that.
We're going to take a quick pause from the show to talk to you about another sponsor today. Now, there's nothing more important than getting a good night's sleep for me to be productive and happy on the job. I work late nights to shoot live PD, so getting good sleep the night before a show is really important for me to do my best work. If you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, you need to try Purple, the world's most scientific mattress. It was developed by an actual rocket scientist, and it feels like you're sleeping in zero gravity. Right now, get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress when you text PD to 84888. You'll love Purple. It uses breathable material so you can sleep cool, too. The mattress is both firm and soft to provide support and comfort. Right now, PD Stories listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. That's in addition to the great free gifts they're offering site-wide. Again, just text PD to 84888. The only way to get this free pillow is to text PD to 84888. That's PD to 84888. Message and data rates may apply.
When we return, we're going to find out a lot more about this important case that was one of the most diabolical and heinous criminal conspiracies in American history. Let's return to our program now. Mark and Julie say that the DC sniper case was a critical moment in their careers. This case was big news. Over the course of 3 weeks, there was a series of coordinated shootings in Maryland, Virginia, and the DC area, leaving 10 people dead. And Mark and Julie, they tackled this case together.
And, yes. And the luxury of that was because we were husband and wife, we were already together, and we were able to respond to mm-hmm. wherever, whenever, which we primarily handled all the shootings mm-hmm. around the Fredericksburg area, which is where we live. Mm-hmm. We wound up going to a shooting at the end of Route 17, which was a wife caught a husband that had been cheating and shot him in the rear end.
Mm.
Yeah.
Butt shot.
Yeah. So we wound up going to that. And then when we were stationed down in Ashland, Virginia, where the one shooting took place outside the Ponderosa.
Uh-huh.
There was the encrypted message that were going back and forth that they were going to get on a cell phone or a pay phone down there. So we were all, there was a group of us out there on each of the pay phones. And that particular time.
Looking for the snipers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was my spotter, and I was on the phone with a rifle. And we were instructed, you know, if we give the word they're on the phone, whoever's got that phone, pull the trigger. You know, we got to stop these guys. Or whoever, because the whole thing about it was a white van. It was a white van, mm-hmm. and it was never
white
a white.
Van.
It was never a white van.
Yep.
And the irony was that car, the machine, the Caprice, that had been seen, but it was never put out. It mm-hmm. was always white vans. You know, when you think about all the plumbers' vehicles and all the other white vans in the D.C. metropolitan area.
Yeah, because for the audience that may not be familiar with this, during the D.C. sniper incident, which lasted a couple of weeks here and terrorized the entire Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia and Maryland, the first reports were that the shooter had fired from a white work van. And so this huge, massive task force that you guys were involved with, and we were involved at America's Most Wanted, everyone's looking for a white van. And it turned out the snipers were using a Caprice that had been modified with a platform out of the trunk to shoot people from the trunk of the vehicle.
Right.
And it was just a terrifying time. And, you know, you guys were in the thick of that hunt. I was at the scene of the woman who was killed at the Home Depot.
Right.
I was at that crime scene, and it was just, we were all just terrified. But when we finally saw who these guys were, everybody was just really, really shocked that one was a teenage boy who had basically been turned into an assassin sniper by this older veteran. It's just a crazy, crazy time. Fugitive cases. There's one that comes to mind. It's legendary here in the D.C. area, Brad Bishop.
Oh, yeah.
He was a State Department diplomat and, for whatever reason, murdered his wife and children in Bethesda, Maryland, and took off as a fugitive. And to this day, he remains a fugitive, correct?
He does.
And you've worked on the pursuit of Brad Bishop for decades now.
For quite a while. And he's still out there. And I think it's a matter of time he's going to get caught. And I think we're still pursuing every possible lead, even though I'm no longer with the Marshal Service. I still stay engaged with the case. Every once in a while, somebody will contact me and we'll talk about it. I have a full file at home that I go through. But that's, you know, everybody talks about that one case that stays with mm-hmm. you. And that particular case has stayed with me from the time I picked it up when I got over at Interpol. And I remember the case, but I was a senior in high school in the area,
mm-hmm.
and I remember the case when it happened, and it was just unbelievable that the guy would do what he did
mm-hmm.
to his family, to his three kids, and
he bludgeoned them to death.
He beat them to death with a ball peen hammer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You also worked on the pursuit of Kobe Mowat. He led a crew called the First and Kennedy Street Crew in D.C., and one of his gang members went into D.C. Metropolitan Police headquarters and shot and killed three law enforcement officials. I know one was an FBI agent.
Right.
One was a D.C. police sergeant.
Hank Daly.
And the third one, can't remember who the third one was, but three people were killed by Benny Lee Lawson in police headquarters. And that, I'll never forget that day because whole city was in shock that a guy actually went into police headquarters to kill police officers. And then Kobe Mowat, who was one of the leaders of the First and Kennedy crew, became a fugitive for a massive indictment coming down on their crew for murder and a whole bunch of other things they've been involved with. And ironically, Kobe Mowat was my neighbor in Hyattsville. He lived two doors down from me. Even though the crew they ran was in Northwest D.C., he lived with his parents because they were teenagers, him and his twin brother. And they lived in Hyattsville. I watched them move out of their house. And about a month later, his file landed on my desk as a fugitive. And you remember how he was caught, Mark?
Oh, yeah. When he wound up being tracked to Africa.
Yeah. So he fled. Kobe Mowat fled from the D.C. area. I believe you tracked him through Russia. And from Russia, somehow he made it down into Africa.
Right.
And then tell the rest of the story.
He was pretty much found in the middle of nowhere in a hut.
A mud hut. Yeah.
Yeah. Living a very secluded, very simple life, given the operation that he had here in D.C. and the notoriety and what they were doing. It was not one of your typical fugitive cases as far as the lifestyle that he was accustomed to that he continued.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was in the middle of nowhere, and it was
Tanzania, wasn't it?
Yeah, Tanzania.
Uh-huh. And he got caught because he couldn't live without one thing, weed.
Yeah.
He was living out in the middle of nowhere in Tanzania in a mud house as far from D.C. as you can get and from the gangster life and the nightclubs and all that. And he had to have weed. And he started growing weed, and Tanzanian police busted him for growing weed. And when they took him in, they found out he was an American and a fugitive and contacted you guys. And U.S. Marshals, you had to go get him and bring him back. Julie, you did some work in Tel Aviv, right? In Israel?
I actually did an extradition out of Tel Aviv where we brought two individuals back. One wanted in Boston, a female, and the other one wanted in Central California,
mm-hmm.
Los Angeles. We did a charter because the female had actually stated that she had mental issues and was very... I won't say combated, but not willing to come back, mm-hmm. even though they found her extraditable and told us we had, I think it was less than 7 days to come over, get her, and get out. She was wanted on making threats to the family that was involved in that. Also, fraud. She had falsified some documents in order to get into or have access to family members' information. So it was threats and fraud. To make the best of that, we had to do a charter flight. Normally they do it on a commercial flight, but unfortunately if they show out or cause problems or disturbance, then the pilot can ask us to leave. And all we can do is pick them up and take them off, give them back to the foreign authorities, which interferes with the time frame. So we did a charter flight, going over, landed in Tel Aviv. It was amazing because once we landed there, the Israeli National Army actually stood guard on that plane while it was on soil. The treatment we received was amazing. The following day, they brought the individuals to us. The male, like I said, was no problem. The female was the one that, you know, she was saying she was crazy, out of her mind. None of this
was
is
it
true.
An act?
It was.
So she was feigning like
she was
crazy. Okay.
Big time. But the nice thing is, especially during a charter flight, not only having a few more deputies than we would normally do on a commercial flight, we also, that trip, had our psychologist.
U.S. Marshals psychologist?
Yes.
Okay.
That he accompanied us. He didn't say anything, didn't do any interviews, but he just sat close to her in which she talked. She told the whole story on how she was faking it. She did make the threats towards an individual.
She told y'all?
She told him that, not
us.
Oh,
she told him?
She told him. She didn't know who he was, but she knew he wasn't a deputy.
Okay.
So that was fine with her. She told him pretty much her life story and how it got to that point where at one point she was having an affair with him. He broke it off, and then that's when she became extremely bitter, threatening his wife and his children and everything else. Laid it out for him. Well, when we landed in Boston, of course, they take her custody of her and move her. But then our psychologist, once he got back to headquarters, he did his letter, his report, which mm-hmm. went to the judge. And that letter alone led to a plea agreement because she had, he didn't ask her any questions. She mm-hmm. provided everything to him.
Yeah, she hadn't memorandized that. That wasn't a
exactly,
factor.
That was nothing at all. Uh-huh. And so she was shocked that he was a psychologist and actually reported it to the judge. The judge was actually kind of thrown back by it because she, again, came into court that day acting like she was, she needed help.
She went back to the crazy act
once she got back off the charter flight. When he started reading the letter to her, then she knew at that point, okay, let's go plea agreement. And that's what she did. She pled out.
And the other one was a fugitive from California, and there was some connection to a lottery ticket or something?
Oh, yes. He was happy to go back. He was happy to come back to the U.S. because his lottery ticket, which he won, I think it was a $1 million ticket, he wanted to cash in before it expired.
Well, let me get this straight. So the guy wins a lottery ticket, but he has to take off as a fugitive and flees overseas.
Well, he fled before he knew he had the winning numbers.
Oh,
but he still had the ticket.
Okay, so he fled before he knew he'd hit the lottery.
Right.
And then he gets extradited back to the States.
Yes.
And he was kind of looking forward to coming back because he figured even if he was incarcerated, he'd be rich.
Yes. Well, he actually ended up getting, I think it was less than 60 days because he had served some before that, but they'd released him pretrial. He bought the ticket, and it wasn't looking good for him, but he should have stuck around. He took off, found out that was a winning ticket, volunteered to come back mm-hmm. For the extradition, uh-huh. got back on ground.
And he got
probation,
the money.
And he got out. He got released before his ticket expired.
Wow. What do you think makes for a good deputy U.S. Marshal? What are the basic qualities that you both think a person needs to possess to be effective in the job?
People skills. You have to be a good communicator. You have to be a good listener. Sometimes communicating is not saying anything at all, but mm-hmm. just listening and displaying the confidence that you're sure of yourself in, as far as doing your job. Because because you're law enforcement, people will look at you to have the answers. And you're not always going to have the answers, but reassure them. Say, listen, I don't know. Don't make something up. I don't have the answer, but I will work real hard to get the answer, and we'll work through this. I think a big thing is communicating, and sometimes, like I said, that just listening and not saying anything at all, it works very well.
How about you, Julie?
I think also the ability to adapt to a situation and under duress. You have a lot of times where a lot of these guys are coming to, like, the District of Columbia, and they're not used to the various cultures here.
It's a culture shock.
It is.
But D.C.
In Washington, D.C. Yes. Mm-hmm. They're coming from cross-country here, so they're not used to it. But they come with a certain attitude. You have to be able to adapt that attitude for the situation you're in. So a lot of times it's listening first, watching, observing where you're at, knowing where you're at, and then the ability to communicate. Just don't make an assumption of what you've heard in the past. If you've never dealt with it, then give it a chance to work out. Don't just immediately make, stereotyping is a big thing. You got to stop that. You got to wait, deal with the person, and then make a decision. But you have to have that ability to do it right away. Not just, I'm going to do it this way, and then you get an aggressive response, or you're not getting them to comply or give you any information, then you get upset because you can't do it that way.
It's a game. It's a game you got to learn how to play. It's a game. You're not always going to get the truth. Just because you have a badge and a gun doesn't mean you're going to get the truth. and you learn to play it through communicating and understanding what people have to say and why they say it. You know, and it's, and again, like Julie said, it's understanding that culture, and especially here in D.C. D.C. is a great environment to work.
What makes it different than other cities from your perspective?
I think the bureaucracy that you're contending with as a federal agency being in the backyard of Capitol Hill, dealing, you know, with the various socioeconomic and cultural things here in D.C., And
the different neighborhoods. Different characters of the neighborhoods.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Is there anything you'd like to add about your careers before we wrap up? Looking back, you have a combined half a century of federal U.S. Marshal experience between the two of you. If someone's listening and they think, maybe I want to follow those footsteps and become a U.S. Marshal, what would your advice be to some young person if they think about doing it?
It's more than what you see on TV and in the movies. I tell that everybody, and I've had quite a few young people come to me and want to talk about doing the job, and I tell them, I said, listen, it's more than just what you see on TV and the movies. It's a commitment. It's definitely a commitment. There are some obvious rewards from it and everything, and you know, 20-something years ago, I met my best friend, and I married her, you know.
I like how you said 20-something.
Yeah. But
within that time frame.
But you wouldn't tell them that you may find your wife along the way, you never know, right?
No, you never know.
Go into this line of work, you know, what would you recommend are the best things that a person should be thinking about as they contemplate, do I want to be a U.S. Marshal?
My thing would be is if you want to become a marshal or actually anything in law enforcement, make sure that it's something that you want to do. It's not about the money, the salary, or anything. It's about your heart. Where's your heart at? Are you given to service? Because the big thing is protect and serve. If you're not of that mindset or willing to sometimes pay the ultimate sacrifice, this is not the field. I've actually had to say that to two individuals I supervised, which they did leave and go back to what they were doing before. But It's not just a job. It's actually your lifestyle. Everyone becomes your family. You know, they say, I bleed blue. That's so true. Mark and I, before we met each other, had pretty much dedicated our lives to the career choice we made and stuck with that. And it's not just on duty, it's off.
Well, it's been a pleasure having both of you in studio here on PD Stories. We go back a long ways, and really, really happy to get to spend this time with you. And you're still working. You just can't seem to give it up, and you're still sort of in the manhunt on some things when you need to be, too. So, you know, what's that saying the U.S. Marshals have? It's a Hemingway quote.
Oh.
There is no hunting.
Nothing like the hunting of a man.
Yeah. Mm. And it basically is you just can't think of doing anything beyond that. I used to be able to quote it right off the top of my head.
I think there is no hunting like the hunting of armed men, and those who have hunted armed men never cared for anything else thereafter.
Correct. Sure.
Well, I'm still hunting fugitives on Live PD, man. And we're catching some, too. Our mission continues on Live PD, and I couldn't be happier to be able to do what I'm doing.
You're very good. You're very detail-oriented. And you pick things, you pick them apart very well.
And I love Live PD. Once you start, you gotta watch it all the way through.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's a phenomenon, and I'm just so blessed to be a part of it. And policing is a very complicated thing in America right now. Being able to sit down and have these conversations is priceless. And hopefully we add some benefit to the discourse about policing in this country through PD Stories and having professionals like yourselves from law enforcement come and give those perspectives. Listen, thank you both for being here on PD Stories. Keep doing great things.
Definitely.
Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk. with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.